he makes that recommendation to me, I want you to know I'm going to approve that.
More assurances from defense officials that the 425 will stay in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a state wolf kill on federal land highlights conflicting policies over predator control.
They are doing what the legislature and the governor has asked them to do, and we are asking them to pay some attention to what Congress has asked us to do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Now, even the Secretary of Defense says he would reverse the plan to cut nearly 3,000 troops from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. This further increases the likelihood the 425 Brigade Combat Team will stay in Anchorage at least for another year. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter told Senator Dan Sullivan today that Alaska bases host forces critical to many defense scenarios.
With respect to the 425, I looked into that after our conversation. I've spoken to General Milley. If he makes that recommendation to me, I want you to know I'm going to approve that.
Thank you.
General Mark Milley, the Army Chief of Staff, told a Senate committee last month it would be contrary to strategic national security interests to dismantle the 425 now. Milley said the team should be extended at least a year. But according to Carter's testimony today at the Senate Armed Services Committee, Milley hasn't yet made the formal recommendation to the Defense Secretary. Rural Alaskans can pay 3 to 5 times as much for electricity than those in urban areas. That's why the state launched the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund in 2000. It's paid roughly $40 million annually to subsidize rural energy bills, but some are questioning whether the fund, which now is worth $900 million, should be committed to benefit only about 1 in 9 Alaskans. Senate Finance Committee Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon, an Eagle River Republican, says the state government could consider tapping the fund.
You'll see power cost equalization come before us. There's $1 billion in that fund. That $1 billion has been benefiting a selected group of Alaskans with power cost equalization. But is that the highest and best use of those dollars now? And so we're looking at all those things.
McKinnon is a sponsor of Senate Bill 196, which would dedicate fund earnings to specific purposes. In years where fund earnings are greater than the amount needed for the Power Cost Equalization Program, 60% of the excess earnings would go to the state government. 30% would go to renewable energy projects, and 10% would build up the endowment. The fund lost money this year, so no excess money is available. It's not clear whether McKinnon and other lawmakers would look beyond Senate Bill 196 to use the fund to help close the state's budget shortfall. Bethel Democratic Senator Lyman Hoffman, another sponsor of the bill, sees Senate Bill 196 as a way to protect the fund's principle while helping the state.
So what we're trying to do with this bill is to assure that during those high years that fund only pay for its intended purpose, and if there are excess earnings, that those earnings be sent back to two different programs.
Governor Bill Walker wants to make sure that if changes are made to the fund, they're considered along with his plan to close the budget shortfall. He wants to ensure everyone in the state shares the burden. Walker expressed concern that the combined impact of power cost equalization changes with potential permanent fund dividend cuts would put too much of the burden on rural Alaskans.
That's why we have focused on a sustainable plan that is a broad-based plan so that we take in consideration rural Alaska's situation, which is unique versus an urban Alaska. So we've tried to take all that in consideration. That's why one piece at a time doesn't really work. It really has to be a plan that is a broad-based plan.
The Senate Finance Committee heard testimony supporting Senate Bill 196 on Wednesday, but didn't vote on the bill. State wolf control in the vicinity of Yukon Charley River's National Preserve has prompted agencies to pursue better cooperation. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a wolf was killed by the state inside the preserve earlier this month.
The wolf kill was the result of a state predator control effort northeast of Delta Junction. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Regional Supervisor Darren Bruning says a wolf initially targeted March 9th on state land from a helicopter ran into the nearby Yukon Charley River's National Preserve.
A wolf was shot and mortally wounded outside the preserve within the authorized control area, and Fish and Game personnel follow the wolf in order to humanely dispatch it.
The incident follows others in past years in which Yukon Charley-based wolves have been shot by the state outside the preserve. NPS spokesman John Quinley attributes the ongoing situation to conflicting state and federal predator management policies.
They are doing what the legislature and the governor has asked them to do, and we are asking them to pay some attention to what Congress has asked us to do is for terms of managing more natural populations of wolves. And on that border, those two management directives bump into each other, and it's not always easy.
Quinley says the wolf shot earlier this month was not radio collared or otherwise identifiable as a park animal, adding that the state is within its authority to kill wolves, but that the NPS would like it to avoid preserve-based animals.
In the past, we have shared information about packs of wolves that spend most of their time in the preserve. I don't know if there's willingness to avoid some of those wolves or not. There has not been in the past, but that would still be something that we would be interested in.
Quinley says NPS and state wildlife officials plan to meet on the issue. The state's Bruning confirms that, adding there's potential for better cooperation.
Coordinate our operations and to share information about our operations and to review our protocol in order to minimize the chances for something like this happening again.
The state of Alaska credits the wolf control program begun in the area in 2006 with helping drive 2-4% annual growth of the 40-mile caribou herd. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The massive die-off of a widely distributed North Pacific seabird continues to surprise federal scientists. The latest twist was the discovery of thousands of carcasses of common murres along Lake Iliamna. U.S. Geological Survey research wildlife biologist John Pyatt says an estimated 6,000 to 8,000 carcasses were counted last month at the lakeshore. Common murres spend winters at sea. Hyatt says if he saw a murre in a lake, he would conclude it was a misguided individual. But to have more than 6,000 in a lake is mind-blowing. Federal agencies are trying to determine why common murres are apparently starving. The confirmed carcass count is up to 36,000, and researchers say that's probably a fraction of the deaths. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Haines receives high praise from international skiers and snowboarders.
It's probably the most famous place in the world, and it's the big goal for each skier to come to Haines.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Join the Salmon Project this month as they highlight the salmon lives of Alaskans in communities across the state. Find them on Facebook or visit salmonlife.org to make sure you don't miss these powerful stories. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A new report on policing in Anchorage says the city needs dramatically more officers to meet its public safety goals.
This bolsters what we've been saying.
Mayor Ethan Berkowitz campaigned on building up the Anchorage Police Department's staffing levels after declines during the Sullivan administration. The new report by the nonpartisan policy group, the Police Executive Research Forum, or PERF, as it's more commonly known, is an update to a similar study from 2010. It concludes that if Anchorage wants to meet its community policing goals, officers need 40% of their time to be unobligated. That means patrol officers are building relationships and following up on information rather than speeding from one call to another. The report notes that reduced staffing levels the last few years may have shifted the burden of policing less severe infractions, like property theft, to store managers and private groups.
Businesses have to step into the breach to pay for private security. There are opportunity costs for private citizens, and crime is very expensive. And so the cheapest thing we can do, really, is to make sure that we have a police force that is capable of doing the job of providing public safety.
Getting that capacity means adding 67 patrol positions to the 166 that currently exist. The report recommends the department grow to 446 positions once civilian and detective jobs are added as well. Berkowitz says this year's budget begins paying for rebuilding and sustaining that larger police force.
You know, there's this thing about math, is we've got to go through 400 before we can get to 446. But the goal isn't a number. The goal is to make sure that we have enough officers to do the job the way it should be done.
A spokesman for the union representing public safety officers says the administration's actions have been encouraging, even as the department continues to face challenges with recruitment and retention. The municipality of Anchorage is well on its way to producing an updated land use plan for the Anchorage Bowl. As APRN's Josh Edge reports, the map currently in use has not been updated since 1982.
The most recent projections, which have been adjusted since the price of oil has declined, anticipate Anchorage's population will grow between 15,000 and 45,000 people within the next 25 years. That means city planners need to figure out how Anchorage can change to accommodate the growth. The municipality this week hosted two open houses, inviting the public to examine more than a dozen maps outlining everything from public transportation routes to zoning districts. Jody Seitz is an associate planner for the municipality. She's examining a color-coded map of Anchorage, outlining exactly which parcels of land can be used and how restricted development is for each parcel.
Each one of these purple places is a place that is not constrained by wetlands, seismic, topography. It's the net buildable land in Anchorage, and you can see really quickly there's really not much.
The purple blocks of land Seitz is referring to are scattered around the map, but the parcels are small, very small, due in part to the city's position between the Chugach Mountains and Cook Inlet, as well as a variety of state, military, and federal lands. The municipality is limited in how far it can expand outwards. Seitz says this leaves planners with some questions to answer.
The question is, where do you put housing? How do you build the type of housing that is going to use what we have efficiently? And then how do you preserve the land for industry and commerce so that the people can have jobs?
Housing and jobs are not the only questions in need of answers. Seitz says as Anchorage's population grows, other community aspects like schools, grocery stores, and retail outlets must be taken into account as well. These are all issues municipal planners are trying to address with the updated Anchorage Bowl Land Use Plan map. The plan lays the groundwork for what types of buildings can be built where, how dense development can be, and it will shape the aesthetic feel of neighborhoods and Anchorage as a whole. Seitz says future developers will likely be working with existing land in need of revitalization.
So that means that where buildings are deteriorated and really probably should come down, maybe they could be redeveloped. Maybe where there's vacant land, there could possibly be an infill project. And then the question is, how do you make that attractive, accessible, and work with the whole area so that you're not just imposing something that's completely out of character for the neighborhood?
In addition to public comments, data ranging from the city's wetlands designations and seismic characteristics to population density and airport noise are all taken into account. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The commercial herring season opened today more abruptly than in past years. Herring seiners had about 2 days' notice to get to Sitka and then about another 4 hours' notice to prep their gear. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Although winter salmon trolling wrapped up only 10 days ago, this always feels like the opening bell of the commercial fishing season in Alaska.
Five, four, three, two, one, open. Sitka Sound Sacro Fishery is now open. Sacro Fishery is now open. This is Department of Fish and Game.
standing by on channel 10.
That's state biologist Dave Gordon, who manages the commercial herring fishery and who, over the years, has become its voice. Gordon opened fishing at 2:45 Wednesday afternoon along the shoreline of Kruzoff Island, about 10 miles northwest of Sitka. As of press time, fishing had not closed, but the openers are typically 2 to 3 hours as seiners home in on schools of large fish with adequate proportions of females. The value in this fishery comes from the egg sacs inside the females, which are stripped, salted, and sold overseas in Asia. There are 48 active permit holders in the 2016 fishery. That's not a lot compared to other fisheries, but owning a herring permit is a little like owning a silver mine. According to the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, purse seine permits for Southeast Alaska are now worth $227,500, a staggering figure that's actually down from the all-time high permit price of $540,000 in 2011. This year, seiners are targeting 14,741 tons of herring. Processing capacity limits fishermen to no more than 4,500 tons per day. A big harvest day usually means fishermen will take a day off to let processors catch up. The commercial fishery is over when the guideline harvest level is met or the herring start to spawn, whichever comes first. The beginning of spawning is also the beginning of the subsistence harvest of rowan hemlock. Subsistence fishermen cut hemlock branches from the forest and sink them in quiet coves around the inner islands of Sitka Sound. Successful fishermen return to find their branches covered in a thick layer of herring eggs, which they can eat on the spot, cook, or freeze at home, or deliver to family and friends around the state. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Sitka Sound Science Center raises millions of salmon at the Sheldon Jackson Hatchery every year. But recently, the organization started nurturing another type of sea creature. KCAW's Brielle Schaefer has more.
A few weeks ago, Roger Valian was diving on the anchor near the center's salmon net pens when he found a curious white egg mass. He brought this to the attention of Angie Bowers, the center's aquaculture director.
And he came up and said, I don't know what they are. And so I had seen a video of Noah had actually found some eggs and hatched them out last year that they found at Little Port Walter. And I showed him that and said, is this what they look like? So he went back down and got them.
Now, the Sitka Sound Science Center has a very important question to answer. Here's research biologist Lauren Bell.
What are little baby squid called?
The eggs are being kept in a heated tank around 7 degrees or so because any cooler than that and they won't hatch, Bowers says. She's assuming the eggs were fertilized.
You can see the individual eggs in the pods, but you can't see the developing squid yet. So
the common name for these creatures is market squid. Southeast Alaska isn't out of the cephalopods range, which stretches the eastern Pacific Ocean up from Mexico. But typically, spawning for market squid doesn't occur here. And it could be a side effect of climate change. Here's Belle.
Squid are often pointed to as like the kind of animal that might, quote unquote, win or do better with changing climate conditions because they only live 2 years, usually. So they can adapt to changes really quick. Some people theorize that we might see more squid showing up in our waters in future years.
And market squid only live 7 to 9 months, Bowers said. The relatively small squid grow to 8 to 10 inches. Humans use them for bait and food, like calamari. Right now, the squid tank is just an experiment for the center. The scientists want to see if they can actually get the market to hatch. And who knows, Bowers says, maybe one day there will be a squid fishery here. But until then,
we'll just try to keep as many of them alive as we can and just hope for the best. We don't really have any expectations at this point. We're just hoping we get to that point.
And if all goes well, the center will have thousands of little baby squid, also known as hatchlings, in the tank in about a month or so. That's something Belle is really looking forward to.
They're very adorable, baby squid. Lots of squid are characterized by their big tentacles. So they have their 8 arms and their 2 big tentacles when they're adults. But as babies, when they come out, their tentacles are fused together. And that actually starts to separate as they grow.
If they do hatch, Belle says, the Sitka Sound Science Center will throw a squid birthday party. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Brielle Schaefer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Southeast Alaska's largest tribal government is pressing for an intensive environmental analysis of the region's health. It's part of a larger push for protection of transboundary rivers, which flow from British Columbia into the region. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Tlingit Haida Central Council wants to document the region's waterways so it can measure any damage that might be caused by mines on transboundary rivers. Council official Will Micklin says it's lobbying the Environmental Protection Agency and other federal offices to fund a three-year, $4 million effort.
We believe that there needs to be a sustained environmental analysis and data collection and modeling and the development of key indicators that determines what the environmental quality and health of the ecosystem exists in Southeast Alaska.
He said council officials have been meeting with the EPA, the State Department, and other federal agencies. He said it understands there won't be any new appropriations, but it's come up with a plan to shuffle existing budgets.
We have put forward our analysis, and we are expecting back from them in a very short time what kind of cooperation and collaboration we can pursue.
The Central Council has joined fisheries and environmental groups, as well as the Walker-Mulott administration, in lobbying the federal government to get involved in the issue. The concerns focus on the Yunik, Stikine, Taku, and other rivers that flow into Southeast Alaska waters. Rob Sanderson Jr., another council official, said mine development on the BC side of the border could pollute those waterways, damaging commercial fisheries and tourism.
But the most important part, I believe, is our way of life, protecting everything from the fish to the smallest organism in the river.
British Columbia mine developers and supporters have said they've built or will build safeguards to protect regional watersheds. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Governor Byron Mulott has been reaching out to Canadian officials overseeing such issues. That includes new ministers at agencies overseeing environment and climate change and fisheries and oceans. Mulott said he asked about a frequent request of mine critics that a cross-boundary water issues panel called the International Joint Commission take up Alaska's concerns. He said he heard more interest in consultations and agreements already underway.
The bilateral process that British Columbia and the state of Alaska are now engaged in would be the most likely place that an issue or question might suggest a referral to the IJC.
Alaska Governor Bill Walker and BC Premier Christy Clark signed a memorandum of understanding in November that increased the state's role in provincial transboundary mine decisions. Work also continues on a more detailed agreement. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
An international big mountain ski and snowboard competition is back in Haines after making its Alaska debut last year. The Free Ride World Tour tests the skills of alpine athletes from around the world with stops in five countries. The athletes say the slopes in France, Austria, and Andorra don't compare with the mountains in Haines. KHNS's Emily Files has the story.
Haines residents might be surprised to find out the peaks that make up our daily backdrop have a towering reputation across the globe. Here's Eva Volkner, an Austrian skier.
I don't know if people from Haines, if they know how famous their village is, you know, all over the world. Skier and snowboarder, it's probably the most famous place in the world. And it's the big goal for each skier to come to Haines once in a lifetime.
Right. And now the good snow.
Oh, beautiful, tearing up this big chunk of open face.
What a spray.
Eva Volkner is crowning this.
As the commentators watched Volkner's run in Haines last year, they knew she was headed for a first place win among the women skiers. Volkner is leading her category again this year. What is it about the mountains here that make them so special? Swiss snowboarder Anflor Machter says because the mountains are so close to the water, the snow sticks on very steep faces.
And the way it builds up to those beautiful ice creamy spines make it so playful, especially maybe for us snowboarders, is that one perfect shaped terrain and exciting and yet like really, actually really technical and really impressive and a bit scary, but so perfect. And for us, it's the one place you find it. You know it's in Haines, and that's why we're all so excited to come here.
The mountains in Alaska are famous, especially the ones around Haines.
Austrian snowboarder Flo Orli might be the athlete who has competed in freeride the longest, 16 years.
Before Haines was on the schedule, everybody on the tour talked about qualifying for the finals, and now everybody's talking about qualifying for Alaska, because this is a dream of every freerider in the world, to ride these spectacular mountains where the snowpack is so safe that you can ride the steepest faces of our planet.
The pool of athletes is cut by about half before coming to Haines. Only the 30 or so with the top rankings compete here. Orli says this will be his last time competing in the freeride. He says he's looking forward to that moment where he's standing at the top of the mountain about to descend.
It's just focusing on your riding, sticking your jumps, finding your line. It's like you're caught in a dream, and only when you're at the very bottom and you're riding out to the flat, you're waking up again.
Oh, he's fighting his way. He swam his way out of there. Yes, he has made it.
He's on his feet. Oh, my God. What an amazing hit he had there.
Flo Orli succeeds.
It's not easy for Freeride to include Haines in its roster of competition spots. It's the most expensive destination for the tour because of the remoteness and lack of infrastructure in the mountains. All the athletes and crew need to be flown in helicopters. Snowboarder Machter says it's a tough spot, but it needs to be kept in the lineup.
For free riding, it needs to stop here in Alaska, especially here in Haines for that terrain. And I think it would make no sense to have a whole tour around the world competing in freeriding without stopping by in this amazing place.
Now, what the freeride athletes refer to as the waiting game begins. The organizers have to wait for the perfect weather and snow conditions for the competition to take place. Last year, they had to hold off until the very last minute before taking on the mountains. But the athletes say the wait is worth it. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Josh Edge in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey and Brielle Schaefer in Sitka, and Emily Files in Haines. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply. Stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Elder Mentor Program is seeking low-income seniors age 55 or older who have a passion for children and for sharing cultural values. Eligibility information at ruralcap.com. This message sponsored by Rural Alaska Community Action Program, Inc. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.